Before we get started with our conversation with Representative, State Representative Sophie Phillips. Hello, Sophie, by the way.
Hello.
Hi. I want to update everyone on something we talked about last week. Jordan Howell was in with Bill, and we talked about this situation with Michaelina DeJesus. Well, we've published in the call everything we have up until this point. We've actually been following a story for over a year. You guys know we went to the State of the State, and we saw all of that, and we wrote about that, etc. Well, the NOCAP team and Jordan have just published everything we have up until the acquittal on offensive touching 2 weeks ago. A good deal of context in that story was provided by information that we were able to garner via the discovery process. We love the discovery process, folks, because if you want to entangle us in any kind of legal mumbo-jumbo, we are going to use the discovery process. You think you can stop us from FOIA? Maybe you can stop us from FOIA, but you can't stop us from discovery. So anyway, as we said last week, and as the article said, Mikey was convicted of disorderly conduct, is on level 2 probation. But there's also an open issue for an incident that happened the last day of the legislative session last year, June 30th, in which Mikey took another disorderly conduct charge, all after the fact, and you can follow the timeline in the article. I can tell you that when we go through the discovery process and the full accounting of what happened, you're probably going to find out that the actual person who was beat up here was Mikey. But we can dispel with all of that. Just forget all of that. Because what I'd like to do today is call on Highlands Bunker podcast alum, AG Kathy Jennings and Governor Matt Meyer, to drop these charges. Talk to the state police, AG, you're the AG. Just drop these charges. They're nonsense. You know, you want to stand up and you're fighting Trump and you're fighting, you know, people who are getting the law used against them for dissent. Well, then stand up and say, this is not right. This is what Carney did. Because Carney is, he's a bitch. So we can, let's end this now. Don't make us get discovery again and embarrass everybody again for your stupidity. Drop the charges from the June 30th incident. That's a little commentary here from Rob, your friend Rob, at the Highlands Bunker podcast. In the shadow, Rockford Tower, behind enemy lines, in the belly of the Delaware Way Beast. I'm Rob. This is the Highlands Bunker Podcast. Hello. We've already introduced our guest, State Rep Sophie Phillips. Thank you so much for coming in.
Of course. I'm so excited. Thanks for having me.
I very much appreciate it. Carl's here to make sure this all sounds good, and it does sound lovely. What you'll have learned yesterday, as this comes out on the 2nd, but on May 1st, a huge double barrel episode of Storm the Fort about May Day. And I want everybody to listen. If you haven't listened to it yet, stop this. Go listen to that. Actually, no, finish listening to this because that's not going to change. That happened like 150 years ago. So you can go back to that. But in any event. So the first thing I'd like to do is just, you know, thank you. I thanked Ray Moore when she was in a few weeks ago for standing up against the corporate franchise bill, SB 21. Obviously, you know, we tracked that story very closely. We had a lot of people on the inside lobbying and tracking and providing information and just organizing people to come and talk about it. So I know what kind of sort of pressure you all were under. As I said to Ray, I was like, you know, it's one thing to feel pressure, but then it's another thing to feel pressure from some of the stupidest people we know. But that's beside the point. You know, we can't just continue to go on like this and race to the bottom. It's not a good way to get revenue. People don't like it. It creates many, many social problems and fiscal problems even that, you know, we're not going to be able to address. So thanks for trying to stand up for that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a big piece of it, too, is diversifying our revenue. So making sure that we don't rely on this corporate franchise as much as we do now. I think that's what got us into this problem in the first place. And then the other piece of this, too, is we were ignoring the majority of the corporations that are in Delaware, which are those non-controlled companies that did not like SB21. So if you have the few corporations that do like SB21 and they're not going to leave, what about that other 99% of corporations that don't like SB21? Those are the ones that we're worried about leaving now. And I think we've seen already 10 corporations leave Delaware since SB21 passed. So it's just, it was a bad bill. I'm happy that I stood up against it. That was after 6 weeks of studying corporate law, talking to both sides. And I was skeptical of both sides. I really wanted to fully understand the issue so I was making the best decision possible. And I feel like I did. And I wish, you know, everyone else put that time into it too.
Yeah, that was one of my questions was going to be, is anybody taking note of, and I guess the news now is, I guess they put their Google alerts on over at the News Journal. Or whatever, to find out when another company sort of leaves, and I don't know. I mean, we've tracked a little bit of this, and we've had like Jordan Howell and academics and other people try to look and see, you know, what the potential like yearly like atrophy rate is. How many do we lose? How many drop off? You know, and how many do we get? And that type of thing. And you know, there's a natural cycle to it. So on one hand, like, these companies may or may not have left anyway. It's only a handful, you know, so less than a dozen. But imagine if, you know, 21 got jammed up and for some reason didn't pass and these 10 would have left. You'd have seen people just losing their minds, like absolutely losing their minds. But now it happens after it passes and they don't really care because, as you said, very, very pointedly, and you're absolutely right, this was done for a small handful of companies who wield tremendous power. The reason they wield tremendous power is because they exploit this kind of stuff. And they can go in and put the governor up against the wall and put you know, the Senate leadership up against the wall. And that's that. The other piece of it is, and I wanted to gauge your feeling about it, because when you go into Legg Hall, you must feel the weight of our incredible fiscal crisis. I understand we're in a huge fiscal crisis.
Absolutely.
But yeah. Are we? I mean, I don't know. Like, I know everybody talks about it. And it's almost like it's the potential of a fiscal crisis. I feel like the other big part of the revenue is like whatever the federal government chooses to give us from year to year. And now that's going to be probably basically nothing now. So I sort of understand that part of it. But I wonder how it affects like the day-to-day. Is it just sort of like a tagline? Because, you know, we weren't even able to get anything passed with fiscal notes a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. So it's always sort of a built-in excuse, I feel like. But I'd like to hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah, I do think it is getting ready for what could happen because it's so unclear at this point. Because Trump is so unclear at this point exactly what's going on. We get new information every single day of awful things. So we don't really know what's going to come, which is why we're not letting anything out of appropriations at this point until we have a better understanding of what's going on, which I totally understand. I do. And I do think that's also why we need to diversify our revenue to make sure that we don't get stuck in this situation where we do have to hold everything because we're relying on those federal funds so much. But I do think it is something to think about, something to get ready for, because if we do just ignore it and we do fund a lot of things and then we don't end up having enough funding for Medicaid, if we lose Medicaid funding, then we're going to be in a really bad place. So I do understand waiting to fully understand what this is going to look like. But I think at the same time, we do need to really think about diversifying those revenue sources so that we don't have to worry about it as much as we are right now.
Well, in that spirit, I guess I'll just say this. There is a bill that's been filed and is on the table to readjust or, you know, create now more income tiers for tax brackets. So changing the marginal tax rate, so a dollar you make over 250 or over 125 will get taxed at like a marginally different rate. So if we're looking to diversify our revenue so we don't get in this, or it's not as easy to get in one of these problems again, like, this should be, this, you should have done this already. Well, you know what I mean? And I have a feeling I'm going to call bullshit if it isn't done, because I think everybody says the things, and not on you particularly, obviously, but just in general, like, if people want to diversify, if people are scared about the revenue streams, if people want to diversify the revenue streams, pass these tax brackets now.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I'm in full support of it. I think this, like you said, should have happened a long time ago, and it is a great way to make sure that we have more funding coming in addition to, you know, a number of other things. I know Medina and I have been taking a look at it with our policy team as well to try and figure out all the different possible ways that we can diversify. And the tax brackets, honestly, is the most important thing. And we already have a bill for that. So we do need to move forward with that. And it is my hope that we pass it and we can, you know, get away from the politics of this and just understand that this, on its merits, needs to be passed and it is good for the state.
Yeah, and I would go through, like, oh, let's talk about the politics of it. You know, you jammed SB 21 and you jam up stuff that has fiscal notes, and you want to make, you know, you want to use a fiscal crisis, whether looming or perceived or imminent or whatever. If you want to use that as part of the political discourse, then I think we should use it the other way around and say, okay, well, let's generate some revenue. Really, the increments that we're talking about, I did it for myself, and I went through, like, you know, total household income and tried to figure it out. It's so nominal, you know. It's so incredible, you know. It's so marginal at the higher. Now, again, people do make tons of money. Great. $4, $5, $6 million. A lot of them came and testified in favor of SB 21, as a matter of fact. Yeah, let's get, and they probably haven't in trust. They're barely going to pay anything anyway. So let's try to do something to get a little more in, and let's start moving in the right direction as far as, like, how we should be getting our revenue and what it should reflect.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's a conversation our colleagues have all the time about how we need new revenue sources. So this should be a no-brainer. This should have happened, like you said, so long ago. It's a conversation that we've been having for years. I think Paul Baumbach tried to pass a tax bracket bill at some point.
Well,
I think
that was last year. Thing too. Yeah. Kowalko, yeah. This was his sort of one of his bailiwicks for a long time.
Yeah. So we've seen this, and we should have handled this a long time ago. But now we're at a point where, yes, we talked about SB 21 and our worry about funding. We're talking about Trump and the worrying about federal funding. So if we're saying that there's this issue, then right now should be the time to absolutely pass this.
Fingers crossed.
I know.
I just want to let everybody know this is going to be like a little litmus test. If you're talking about fiscal crisis and you're saying we can't do stuff because of fiscal notes and all this bullshit, and you don't pass the thing to help, you know, get a little bit more revenue, then I'm going to call bullshit.
And so, that we had to pass SB 21 so we didn't lose the corporate franchise money.
Yeah. And then, of course, then the 10 companies leave anyway. But we don't talk about that because it doesn't fit your fucking narrative. I want to spend most of the time talking about something you mentioned when you walked in and we just first started talking. Because I wanted an update. Because I always follow things, like, from an arm's length. So I know what's going on, but not like Carl knows what's going on. There was a homeless rights package, basically, that you were sponsoring, I guess, either last session or the session before. What is the status of it? Where is it in the process? I think some changes were made to it. So can you just start and sort of give people sort of an update of where that stands and what you're trying to do and what the timelines are?
Yeah, absolutely. So last year we were able to pass two bills. One bill made housing status a protected class for employment and the other for housing, but we weren't able to get the public accommodation piece done because there was a lot of opposition to that. So we did write up a public accommodations one so that housing status would be a protected class under public accommodations. We haven't filed that one yet. We want to work on the bigger picture first. So the original Homeless Bill of Rights, they've been trying to pass this bill for, what, 13, 14 years at this point. And that has a lot of opposition, which is why I ended up breaking it up into these other two pieces. So now we're going back this year, and we have that larger bill again. We're calling it the Deborah Gilbert Act. after Deborah Gilbert, who is an amazing woman. She has a PhD and she experienced homelessness. And during that time, she asked if Delaware had a homeless bill of rights. And of course, Delaware did not. And so she has been the biggest advocate for it for years, over a decade at this point. So we wanted to make sure that this bill, you know, was named after her for all the work that she's put into it. So this new bill has the same idea, just make sure that everybody, regardless of housing status, has the same rights. But this one is a direct response to the Grants Pass Supreme Court ruling that basically said you can criminalize homelessness. It really didn't put any limitations on municipalities. And that's not okay. We can't have that here in Delaware. Our homelessness rates are through the roof. If we criminalize homelessness, then those folks who are already struggling, if they end up in prison, then say they come out, let's say 3-4 months later, they're in the same communities that they were taken from, but now they have fees, they have a record, they have mental health issues most likely from their time there, and all of that additional stuff with already the struggle that they had, that doesn't do anything good for the community, for society, nothing. So what we want to do is make sure that the most basic level, people that are currently experiencing homelessness have basic rights to, you know, sit on a bench if they want to. Of course, if you're harassing somebody, like anybody, the police can do something about that. But that's regardless of your housing status. If somebody not experiencing homelessness is harassing somebody in a restaurant, the police are going to do something about it. If they're experiencing homelessness, they're going to do something about it. It's equal rights. So at the bare minimum, that's where we're at. Just trying to make sure that everybody has equal rights so that we're not criminalizing people for just trying to survive. And we are filing it. This comes out tomorrow, right?
This will come out Friday.
Friday. Okay. Yes. So May 1st is the pre-file and we are going to have it released that date. So it should be public by Friday.
Perfect. Can you explain a little bit about, so the first two pieces passed.
Yes.
And they are, I guess, having some impact now just for, can you explain what they're doing first? Because then I have a question about the accommodation bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So for employment, it makes sure that if you either don't have an address or if you use something like, I'm forgetting the building name right now, but there are domestic violence survivors right now who use one of the buildings in Wilmington as their address. So it's obviously not a house or an apartment. It's clearly a building. And prior to this bill, you could discriminate based on that housing status. And now employers can't ask about it. They can't use it. They can't stop somebody from getting a job simply based on their housing status. That's the employment. Similarly with housing, you can't deny somebody housing just because, you know, you're currently experiencing homelessness or you're using, you know, one of the city buildings to make sure that you're safe from an abuser. So that's what those are doing. And my hope is that that just lowers the barriers a little bit for folks.
Cool. So what the accommodations basically is just a way to say people can be in a space.
Yep.
They have nowhere else to be, and you can't really police that. What are the, if you had to articulate sort of the arguments against this, I'm going to guess, and then you tell me how close I am.
Okay.
So you mentioned something about fines and fees and money. Mm-hmm. So I can see how, especially in this fiscal crisis that is imminent, I could see how that would be used, but really it's just a thinly veiled way of saying, I don't think these people are human beings.
Yeah.
I mean, because you really have to be pretty low to argue against just the basic accommodations that you're talking about. But, I mean, is that what's happening? Is it just like, are they now maybe in Trump's America you can be more blatant about it and just say it? I don't know. I don't know what the big arguments have been. But what are you facing? What kind of pushback are you facing?
I think the biggest issue is misinformation. So I don't want to say that all the people who are opposed to the bill are like horrible people. I think honestly a lot of people have been misled because of this giant misinformation campaign that, you know, there are going to be tons of people experiencing homelessness setting up camps right outside your restaurant. And they're going to be blocking people from being able to, you know, walk on the sidewalk. Or we're going to end up looking like whatever cities there are that have people just everywhere. And if you look at the three locations that already have a homeless bill of rights, That's not what you see. And you don't see any small businesses closing. In those three states, the small businesses, there's been more and more and more of them. They've been increasing throughout the year since there's been a homeless bill of rights. So at the very least, it's not stopping small businesses from growing. It's not shutting down any small businesses. So it really is a lot of misinformation, not based on any data, any facts, nothing. It's
fear,
just...
a little fearmonger.
Exactly.
We love the fearmonger.
Exactly. It's how can we scare these businesses into making sure that these people don't have rights, so we continue to criminalize them and we continue just move them out of locations in the city. We move them somewhere else. Where are we moving them? Who knows? But the goal is just to move them so we don't have to see them, as opposed to actually getting them the help so that way they can be contributing members of society back into the city. It helps the city to actually help people experiencing homelessness.
I wonder how the population of this country was conditioned to accept people being shipped to El Salvador or Guantanamo out of sight. I wonder how they were conditioned to the... Actually, I don't wonder at all. You know, you raise the perfect point. It's like, well, where are they supposed to go? Nobody has an answer. They don't feel good. And I've said this before, so I'll say it again. More people will listen because we have an esteemed... I think we have the honorable, as they say, Sophie Phillips here. That reaction from people, that like visceral reaction of like fear, of like they're going to be in front of my business or they're going to be setting up in my street. It happened actually in the neighborhood here. I think one of like the small like boutique realtors or something put like a TikTok up or something about like they're going to camp and then we're not going to be able to get them out. And I'm like, okay, let's all take a deep breath. First of all, it's not what it is. But secondly, people are nervous. They do feel uncomfortable, and there's a reason they feel uncomfortable, because we're this is a sign of a failing society. It's a failed city. You should feel bad. You should feel a little bit uneasy. You should feel not scared necessarily, but yeah, I mean, you should have these sort of negative emotions, but it's not because of them. It's because we're not doing anything about it.
Absolutely.
That's why you feel that way.
Yes. And the result of that should be, how can I help, not how can I push these people away? And I know the video you're talking about, it was in front of Cafe Karma, I think. I think he leases the Cafe Karma.
Okay. Yeah, I don't remember. I just remember it was somebody, I didn't even watch it, but I remember somebody sent it and I was like, what is this about? And they told me, and I remember it was around the time, I guess you were, maybe you had a hearing on the original one, or it was before you broke it up, or it was some kind of conversation about that. So I was like, ah, this guy's a jerk. But I mean, it is misinformation, but I think it's misinformation in the way that it's really feeding off of the fact that people know that they should feel bad. They're like, wow, this is bad. Who did this? And they're like, they look in the mirror and they're like, oh, I guess we all did this. Mm-hmm. And that's, and we all have to fix it. There's no other alternative. You know, that's it. So
yeah, and I think it goes back to stereotypes too. People have this very awful view of what people experiencing homelessness look like. So I actually did a talk with the Central Chamber of Commerce, who have always been against this bill, but they invited me to speak on it. So I really did appreciate that opportunity to talk to a bunch of business owners who were in a class with the Central Chamber. And the first slide that I had up was a photo of my uncle, who's currently experiencing homelessness in Montana right now, and my uncle, who was experiencing homelessness in New York City. And the first day that he finally got into housing and stability was the first day I met him, when I was 3. And I immediately ran up to him, and he's still to this day my best friend and hasn't experienced homelessness anymore. And thankfully, he had a family that was looking for him and that was working as hard as they possibly could to get him into shelter and into safety. But not everybody has that. So And then the other people that I bring up are my family members. They're 2 kids and a mom and a dad who've been experiencing homelessness on and off. And one of them was Miss Delaware's teen. And, you know, she speaks about youth homelessness all the time and how it impacts kids going to school who are experiencing homelessness, how it impacted, you know, her ability to be able to do her homework, do all her extracurriculars. And this girl you look at here, you would never know. You would never know that she experienced homelessness. She doesn't fit whatever stereotypes people put on people experiencing homelessness. So I put up these photos to show people what homelessness actually looks like. the people that you're seeing on the street are a small minority of the people experiencing homelessness. And do we need to get them into shelter? Absolutely. Do they fit this stereotype? Unfortunately. And that's what we think everybody looks like. And we think that anybody who fits that stereotype does not deserve help. And that to me is completely unacceptable. And it ends up hurting your community more if you push these people out and if you are not willing to help them.
Yeah. I mean, that's way back in the day. We interviewed a guy who wrote an article for Current Affairs. And it was about the homelessness problem in Western Massachusetts. But it was really about people who don't get like counted. They're like, you don't think of that kind of person as homeless. Like, you know, they're couch surfing, they're living in their car for a period of time, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. And it sort of flies under the radar.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Dr. Deborah Gilbert White is the perfect example. Yeah. She had her PhD and she was, you know, sheltered homelessness. She was trying to find shelter, move from place to place. So she never really was on the street in that sense, but it was only because she used whatever resources that she had to try and get into these shelters. Even though it was a challenge, she experienced a lot of hardships within those shelters. She has a PhD. You never think that somebody with a PhD is going to end up experiencing homelessness. And I think it shows us that it could be any single one of us because you never know what's going to happen. Your house could burn down tomorrow and you might not have a place to go and you end up in a shelter. We are really one step away from being in these people's shoes. And for some reason, a lot of people just can't picture themselves in that way. So they dehumanize the people that are currently experiencing this.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that's important to mention is that just from a realistic data, you know, libs love, they love science. Homeless people do not do any more drugs than housed people. They do drugs and drink. You know, I do drugs and drink. It's fun. I would probably do more if I didn't have a place to live, just to cope. But the same goes for crime, violent crime. There's no metrics that we have to say, oh, an unhoused person who's on the street rough sleeping, say, is going to commit violent crime at any rate higher than your neighbor or the person down the street or anybody. It sort of is what it is. And so, yeah, the whole story is sort of this sort of made up on a stereotype fear factor and really not wanting to face the fact that we created this society, so the issues are ours to fix.
Absolutely. We're all responsible.
Yes. I mean, and frankly, we have more responsibility because we have the power and the resources to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the responsibility is ours.
Yeah. And so in the bill that we have currently, the Deborah Gilbert Act, we make it very clear that there is, you know, an incentive for municipalities to build shelters. Because in the bill, you can't move anybody from a public space unless you have shelter to give them. So like Newcastle County, there's the Hope Center. There are, you know, options there where people could go. And there is a standard for where they can go. It has to make sure that it's, you know, actually a good shelter where they can get everything that they need, like the Hope Center.
Well, and I know that there's been issues with, you know, like hotel vouchers sometimes.
Absolutely.
And then you got to always be on top of the people, you know, the middlemen and women, the middle person who is sort of brokering these deals. Because we very rarely do something like the Hope Center, where we can bring the state's resources to bear and try to run it like that. We always like just contract it out to any fly-by-night thing. So I know that's always a big challenge too, is just to make sure, like, I remember talking to some people who were lost their homes for a period of time because of the floods on Riverside. Same thing. It was like, yeah, we're here, but they keep shuffling us around to different sort of like seedy motels.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, it's not the best situation.
Ooh, we had a really bad situation like that in my district. There was a motel that had all the code violations. We eventually got code enforcement officers there and the folks let them in because you can't just go in as a code enforcement officer. They have to let you in. And there was a lot of those folks that allowed them in and they found roach nests, they found bed bugs, they found that none of the toilets or sinks were working. It was like there's wires hanging off the building. Like every code violation that you can think of was happening at this motel. And finally, we were able to get it shut down. And Carrie Casey, who's incredible, was there to make sure that people could sign up to go to the Hope Center and they were going to make sure that they would get them there and get their stuff there. So thank God for her and her having humanity and making sure that people are going to be somewhere safe since they are no longer going to be allowed to be in this motel. But the situation they were in was completely inappropriate. And I believe there is someone who's staying there. She said that she was with the Horizon House. Why would they ever let somebody stay in a place like that? That's not going to help them get any better. It's really not going to help them, you know, be able to get jobs or anything, because there's not even like a bus stop there. Like, there's just, it was completely ridiculous that that was even an option. And that's what we're seeing more and more and more. That's what exists right now. And so in the bill, we made it very clear that it has to be shelter that actually provides all the needs, that doesn't have any code enforcement issues at the bare minimum. And like, Georgetown has the Pallet Village, Newcastle County made the Hope Center. So City of Dover, you have every, you know, everything in your power to create something similar. You really can do that. And there's tons of funding available to help you do that. But it just seems like these places haven't tried or haven't put the effort into it. Instead, they just want to move people. So the way that this bill works is you can't move anybody unless you have somewhere to actually bring them. So that should hopefully incentivize municipalities to start building shelters. So at the very least, right now, they have somewhere that they can go for a night or for a week or however long that they need to be there.
The other thing I'd like to talk about regarding this topic is sort of a thing. It's like a no-cap thing, like police reform thing. A lot of these interactions that necessitate, you know, people coming out and make sure you have a place to go, or trying to get people help, or, you know, whether it be medical help or drug treatment or whatever. The cops are always there. And it's been my experience and the ones that I've been around that not only the cops are there, the cops are sort of running the show. And they'll provide the sort of just enough intimidation to talk somebody into talking to a caseworker, but the caseworker will really be taking their lead from the cop as far as, you know, how to treat this person, you know, how sort of open to be, you know, just how the reaction is going to go. And I feel like we have to get armed agents of the state out of this process as much as we possibly can. Now, I know that's probably not as part of this bill. We just need to get people like level set, like you said, that they can actually exist in space. Fair enough. But I did want to bring that up because I've heard about some other models, just response models for homelessness like this, that is a lot more helpful. Because it's just one thing sticks in my mind about one of the recent sweeps that I was there for. About people saying, look, we tried to help this guy three times. They don't want our help. They don't want... I'm like, yeah, because every time you come here, it's at the tip of a gun. Really?
Yeah, it
takes... And so, like, what do you expect a person... Do you expect a person to be, like, really jazzed about this interaction? Mm-hmm. When it's, like, you know, the armed state agent is like, do this, do that. You can't do this. Move your shit. We're taking your shit.
Yeah, talk about scary.
Yeah, it's just crazy.
Yeah, and it takes a long time to get, you know, people to trust you. I mean... Honestly, when I, you know, see someone on the street experiencing homelessness, I always give them my card so that they can, you know, call me, email me, whatever it is. If I just told them at that moment, like, get in my car, let's go here, they shouldn't do that. Because why would they just get in this random stranger's car? Or why would they just do whatever you tell them to do? Why would they trust you? So it took me a year to make a relationship with a man experiencing homelessness until we were able to get him to a service center. I was told that because he was on Medicaid that he would qualify to go to the Hope Center, and that's all he's wanted. His girlfriend was shot because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time because they were experiencing homelessness, and they had tried to get into the Hope Center multiple times and failed. So this time I was like, all right, he's already gone through so much trauma. He, you know, goes to a therapist to make sure he's getting help with his mental health. Like, he really wants to get better, and he really wants to make sure that he's somewhere safe. That's all he wants. So I felt so bad when he walked all the way to the state service center, found out that he's on the wrong Medicaid to be able to get into the Hope Center. He had to go upstairs to fill out this long report to then get it mailed where? So now he's still experiencing homelessness because of this process that we have in place. And it took a year of me texting him, talking to him constantly, checking up on him. At this point, he feels like an uncle. Like, he calls me his niece at this point. Like, we have that relationship now because I worked really hard to grow that relationship, and he worked with me to grow that relationship. Of course, if police are showing up in a moment where they're trying to move you and they're saying whatever they're saying to you, it's never usually in a calm, nice manner. Like, they shouldn't trust you. Why would they do that?
Yeah, that's like, I try to tell people, like, just think about it, like, maybe for 5 seconds the other way around. And would you be like, oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
this is a nice interaction that I'm having. This will benefit me in some way.
Exactly. I'm just going to listen to whatever they say because that's worked out for me before. Like, ugh.
So before we go, what else is going on? Like, how are you doing down there? Because I know it's, from what I understand, it's not the most pleasant place to be sometimes. Mm-hmm. I know that you have, your priorities, but there are also other things people are working on that sort of everybody are trying to get behind, like Raymore and the school lunches and that type of thing. What else are you working on? Is there anything else that we can point to by the end of the session and be like, oh, I'm glad we did that thing?
Yeah, I think the most important one to me is my size discrimination bill that adds height, weight, and body size to protected classes. And that one came from one of my best friends over a year ago. They founded the Fat Collective in Wilmington, and there's one bill in the country like this in Michigan that was actually started by very petite women who wanted to be firefighters and were told that they were too small to do it. Now we know at this point that petite women are now firefighters and have had the ability to do that for now decades because of those women working so hard to make sure that they were going to get a bill that made it so those employers couldn't discriminate them just based on their body size. So, Francisca and the Fat Collective, along with a number of other communities, have been working with me to make sure that this bill is everything that they dreamed it would be. There's municipalities that have this as well, but this would be the strongest one in the country. And I'm really excited about it. We have a huge coalition behind it. My favorite podcast host ever, who has a ton of books, and she hosts Maintenance Phase, Aubrey Gordon. She's my expert witness. And the head of NAFA, Tigris Osborne, is going to be an expert witness as well. These are people who truly understand the data, the stats, the facts, the reasons why this is needed, and the success that it's had in municipalities and in Michigan. So I'm excited about that.
You gave a good example for the one. If you can meet the physical checklist to be a firefighter, then it really shouldn't matter. If you can do the things. On the flip side, what types of discrimination are the larger people experiencing? I mean, I can imagine some social stigma, like that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But what's sort of the official stuff that's happening that we're trying to address?
Yeah, honestly, so much, which is why we're going to have a number of folks sharing their experiences, because, I could sit here forever and tell you all the different experiences that these folks are having, but I want them to be able to say it in their own words. But one of the biggest ones that I think you're going to hear a lot is in the medical field. There's a lot of folks who just don't go to the doctor anymore because they have had awful experiences where they go for, like, their ear is, infected. Aubrey actually had talked about this. She, like, gets double ear infections sometimes. And when she goes to the doctor, they don't pay attention to the ears. They don't even ask about it. They just say, oh, you need to lose weight. Like, you need to go on Ozempic. Not asking if she's already been on Ozempic, which she has 3 times. Not asking if she has an eating disorder, which she has had at a time when they told her that she needed to lose weight. And so it comes to a point where you don't want to go to the doctor anymore because you're experiencing all these negative things when you get there, and you're being told that you're overweight, even though they're not looking at, anything inside your body. She was actually told to be put on a statin. She went to a new doctor and they said, why did they put you on this? Your blood pressure is already low and this is actually going to lead to a stroke. Like, you should absolutely not be on this. And she said, they just put everybody who's my size on this. So they don't even take a look at what's actually going on. And I think that's the biggest type of discrimination that folks are seeing. Sometimes they can't get the medical care that they need because they're above whatever weight they need to be to be able to get even just basic care. So I've heard a number of those stories. And even if you think about overweight, obese, these terms, they're based on the BMI. And the BMI was never meant to be on an individual level. It was supposed to be population-based. And there's a whole maintenance phase episode on where the BMI came from and how it's used today and how it changes every year. And it gets, you know, the level of obese gets like less and less and less. So even like my mom was told that she was overweight. And I can guarantee you like that's really dangerous for her to think that she's overweight. My boyfriend was told that he needed to lose weight after a doctor used a literal app with ads to tell him what his BMI was. And if anyone knows Brian, like that would be so dangerous for him to lose weight too. So there's a lot of these situations where, you know, the BMI is being used when it shouldn't be being used because we know where it came from and we know that it's BS at this point. And there are folks who can't get medical care that they need because of whatever BMI level we're at. And those folks then don't want to go to the doctor anymore because they're not getting the basic care that they need when they show up. And they leave feeling, you know, really bad about themselves. Sometimes they leave with eating disorder. Sometimes they leave with medication that's dangerous for them. So a lot of it will be in the medical field, but there's a ton of other situations this day to day where people experience discrimination based on their body size.
How do we have any sort of feel for how those sort of laws that would be applicable to medical professionals, how that would play out? Because I wonder, and I don't have any medical training, but I would expect that, you know, doctors always give you the sort of the same rundown about like, do you smoke? Don't smoke. You know, don't drink so much coffee. Caffeine's bad, and you could lose 20 pounds. You know, kind of thing. And, you know, I guess I never thought of it. I could probably potentially lose 15, just to be honest. But
but why? But why do you think that?
I don't know. Because of BMI's bullshit, probably. I've been sold on the BMI bill of goods, probably.
Well, and it's just know. What society tells you whatever thinness is what you should be. But if you look at history, what it used to be is the bigger you were, it showed that you were rich. It showed that you were powerful. And those who were really skinny, they were really poor. They were looked down upon. And now it's flipped. And it's always the people who are low income that are screwed by this. Because at the time, it was those low income people who were thin and they were looked down upon. Now, it's the flip side. It's like, oh, lower income people don't have access to fresh food. They're bigger and we need to fix them. So it's always this population that is impacted by this. And we never look at the history and where this is coming from.
It's a fair point. Because you're definitely right about that. I mean, through history, you know, you could eat richer foods. You didn't have to work. You know, all of that kind of stuff. So yeah, generally, you know, the successful, wealthy, powerful people were big fatzos.
And I think this is really important, and my favorite piece of this is how intersectional it is, and when that changed. So it changed from folks being, you know, bigger sizes, and that being seen as good and powerful. That changed during slavery. Because, you know, those of us who are like multiracial, I'm Black Indian, like we have like different figures, and my family members have different figures than those who are, you know, my white family members, for example. Like you could see the difference because we just like look different. And so folks of color were now being discriminated against because of that body size. And because they looked a certain way, then anybody who was white, who was bringing slaves over, said, ooh, I don't want to look like that. So now we have to switch the narrative because I need to set myself apart from these slaves that are coming over and we don't want to look like them. That body size is bad. So now let's switch it over. And that's really when you saw this big switch. So it is super intersectional. There's a bunch of books actually about the Black body and like what that history looks like and why we have these thoughts that we do today and how it really is based in that racism and classism.
Well, plus it just intersects like all different kinds of like race, politics, gender, everything. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you go to the doctor and you get this rundown, or even like you said, in your day-to-day life and you're getting treated a certain kind of way. That transcends because it's just a visual thing, right? That people mm-hmm. usually do. So it's like it'll transcend like politics. It could be Chris Christie or Pritzker, either one. Mm-hmm. It's the same. All right. Well, thank you for coming in.
Of course.
I very much appreciate it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get you in trouble by asking you any troubling questions. I will say, I'll put it to you this way. If you speak to anybody and you'd be like, I was on the podcast and whatever, and they're unsure about it, or they say something like, well, he said something I didn't like once. Did you listen to it? No, somebody sent it to me. First of all, I'd like all of the friends of the podcast who are down there to make sure people, you got to listen to all of them. You got to listen to them from beginning to end, every one of them. So you got to go back to episode one if you missed it, and you got to start. Otherwise, you can't really understand what I'm doing. That's number one. Number two is, and I don't know if people are going to be open to this, but I've kind of hinted at it before, but when I mention you and I make fun of you and we ring the bell and all that stuff, or we say outrageous, we make an outrageous joke or something, and then I find out that you're mad, I'm only going to do it more, because that's the best. Like, I tried to make you mad, rather than just ignoring it, you wanted to tell everybody that you were mad. Well, now I know you're mad. And now, choo! First of all, I'll tell you, and even Carl knows this, we go right into the our private chats, and we make fun of you. Whoo, man, we make the... you couldn't believe the jokes we tell in the private chats. It's incredible. So my recommendation would be, if somebody sends you a clip and you hear it and you don't understand, it's best to just ignore it. Otherwise, don't add fuel to the fucking fire. You know who you are. Don't lie. They know who they are, don't they? They know who they are.
And also, why do they care? Don't care about what people think about you.
Hey, look. That's just what they do. I mean, look, this is a politician's... This is the politician's dilemma, right? Because, like, your whole gig is, like, getting votes. So it's like, I gotta care what everybody thinks. But do you have to care what everybody thinks?
No, you should care what your constituents think, because they're the ones that you're there for.
Well, there are some people who represent me who aren't too happy with me either, to be honest with you. But that's a whole nother story. All right, folks. We'll be back next week, as always, with more riveting conversation on the Highlands Bunker. I can tell you that there will be another state representative making their debut here in the studio. I don't want to mention who it is, but they'll be here.
Frank Cook, welcome to the podcast.
So, you weren't supposed to say anything. Now it's never going to come off now. Yes, Mimi's coming in. We're going to have a great conversation. Holy shit, that's funny. Well, maybe it is. Maybe it is Cookie. Who knows? That would be very funny. Sophie, thank you so much.
And I do think if you disagree with somebody and you get mad at someone, it's actually worth going on their podcast and having that conversation. You never know where that conversation will lead. It could be really positive.
We're going to clip that. We're going to use that as like a promo. It could, you know what? It could be very positive. I've actually asked people, I would say, look, you can come in, you know, yell at me, you know, try your country bumpkin stupid shit in here and see how it flies. You know, if it doesn't fly in here, you know, maybe try something else. You know, try some of the stuff you try to sell to the rubes. That's what I say, selling it to the rubes. I don't buy any of that. No. We can't have that. So again, while I agree with Sophie that you should come in, you should be open, we should be able to have a civil discussion, I'm all for that. Am I gonna have to call you out a little bit? Maybe. I don't know. But you don't know until you try.
Facts. Don't know until you try.
Boom. Sophie, thank you. Carl, thank you. And yeah, left is best.